Acts chapter 27, we'll read from verse 1. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius, and embarking in a ship of Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, and as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbour was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbour of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind, called the northeaster, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught, it could not face the wind. We gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Corda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo, and on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship, and he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island.' When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved.' Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. And as day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you.' And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach, on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. Just so far. Jason will now bring us the sermon for this morning.
Well, our passage this morning once again raises a question that we've already looked at a little bit in our journey through Acts this year. If the Lord appointed Paul on this mission to the world, then why does it seem as though the Lord is now hindering that mission? That's the big question that we need to come back to as we try to process chapter 27 here. But first, I think we need to track through some of the details of this narrative and try to visualize and make sense of what we've just been reading. And just in terms of where we're up to, there's been 5.5 chapters, I think, of Paul being dragged around the courts in Palestine. Now he's being sent to Rome to be tried before Caesar. That's our context. He's charged with nothing, if you remember. He's charged with nothing but having been teaching people about Jesus. And so that's why our passage today starts by telling us that he's headed to Italy, because he's going to Rome to appear before Caesar, just to jog your memory. That's why verse 1 says, "It was decided that we should sail for Italy." And so they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. So that's what's going on here in Acts chapter 27. At long last, it seems, Paul is finally going to Rome. And we might note too that our friend Luke, who wrote this book of Acts, is travelling with Paul. And we can tell that by the way he uses first-person plurals again when he says, for example, "we should sail for Italy," and so on through this chapter. So too, there are other companions of Paul's with him, at least Aristarchus, who gets a notable mention in verse 2, but probably others. And of course there's the Romans guarding all the soldiers, and therefore there's others guarding all the prisoners, and therefore there's other prisoners, as we read. There's also the ship's sailing crew. So there's a lot of people here. If this was a private ship, which it may well have been, that the Romans seconded for their purposes to get these prisoners to Rome, then there's possibly even merchants and other kind of travellers on board as well. Anyway, that's the scene that we're looking at here as they set out. And things seem straightforward for the first couple of verses. It's almost pleasant, even, the way that it reads. And we might even think that, gee, after 5.5 chapters, after more than 2 years of being dragged around the courts in Palestine, Paul might be quite relieved to be getting onto this boat and getting out of there and heading to Rome. And as they generally have done, notice, throughout this ordeal, the Romans continue to treat Paul well here. We read there in verse 3, when they get to the first pit stop in Sidon, he's even allowed to go and visit his friends. But in verse 4, we get the first hint of what's coming in the rest of this chapter. The plan was straightforward enough to set sail from that port city of Sidon there on the coast of Palestine and head over to the ports of Asia. They found a ship that's heading to the ports of Asia. Gnidus would be the southernmost port in Asia that they would hit, but who knows where they're going to. There's all kinds of ports up the coast of Asia once they get to Gnidus. Halicarnassus, Miletus, Ephesus, Smyrna, Mytilene, Troas, Abydos, who knows where they're going, but they're going to the ports of Asia, and so that's going to get them halfway to Italy, and so the Romans pick up this ship, and presumably, once they're there, they'll pick up a second ship and do the second half of the journey to Italy. That's the plan, and it sounds great. But that plan goes a little bit sour in reality, because the winds are so strongly against them that they got to sail instead around the coastline in the lee of that big island Cyprus there. And they only get as far as the port of Myra in Lycia. Nevertheless, the centurion in charge of all this, Julius, he does manage to secure a second ship there. And Plan B gets underway. They set off for Italy again from Myra. But again, it was hard work. It was slow going, verse 7 tells us, to get even as far as that first Asian port that they were originally heading for. It was hard work because once again, the winds would not allow them to complete the journey that they set out on. So instead, they again have to sail around the safety of another island, this time Crete there, until they reach a harbour there called Fair Havens. So things are not going well. And at this point, Paul suggests to them that the rest of the journey that's still to come is still going to be difficult like this. And it's going to be dangerous, he says. And when Luke says there in verse 9 that dangerous because even the fast was already over, that's just a time marker for us. That just marks where we're at in the year. The word there, the fast, refers to the fast associated with the Day of Atonement. FYI, in that year, this is AD 59, in that year the Day of Atonement fell on what we would today call the 5th of October. So that's the time marker Luke puts there. And Luke's not interested in the fast itself or the Day of Atonement it's associated with, the celebration. He's just referring to the date and specifically the lateness of the date. It's already October. It's already October. And in Roman thought and in the system of navigation in those days, the Mediterranean was considered safe for sailing until mid-September. It was uncertain after mid-September. And by early November, it was altogether closed. There's no navigation on the Mediterranean between early November all the way through to early March over the winter season. Not just because winter's miserable and cold and wet and it'd be unpleasant, but because of winter storms, devastating winter storms and fog and overcast skies that made navigation on the Mediterranean almost all the time hopeless. So as Paul stands there in October, warning them in Fair Havens not to continue any further, in verse 10, we might notice that the sailing season itself is only a few weeks out from being closed altogether anyway. And perhaps Paul senses here that, you know, the difficulty that they've already had so far might be a bit of a warning, a heads up that the storm season is coming a bit earlier than usual this year. And the crew kind of listen to Paul. In a sense, they kind of listen because they do decide that the rest of the trip to Italy, okay, it'll have to wait until after winter. But in another sense, they don't listen because they don't particularly want to spend winter in this port of Fair Havens. For whatever reason, they see it's unsuitable. And so they decide instead to travel just about 20 nautical miles up the coast to a better harbour, Phoenix, a better harbour of Crete, and spend the winter there. So against Paul's warning, verse 13, a nice gentle breeze picks up and they have a crack at that. Plan C gets underway. But once again, the reality proves far worse than the planning. A typhoon wind called the Northeaster blew them well off course, straight out to ocean. And I don't know why our ESV doesn't have a capital N, but Northeaster should have a capital N there, like the NIV that I know some of you are looking at this morning, because it's actually the name of the wind. It's called the Northeaster, a bit like we have our doctor here in Perth. That part of the Mediterranean has, if you're looking at a King James or a New American Standard this morning, you're looking at the original words, the original names for this, the Euroaquilo, or the Euroclidon, it's called, which our ESV and NIV just call the Northeaster. It's a far more powerful wind than our Fremantle Doctor. When the Euroaquilo rips through the Mediterranean, it causes absolute chaos for anyone on the water, as we then see happening in our text. The ship simply cannot be turned into the wind to avoid what's coming, and so they have no choice but to surrender and just be driven along by it. The 20-mile spin up along the coast to Phoenix turns into a two-week disaster, lost at sea. Swept briefly past the tiny little island of Corda, it mentions, and once they're past that, it's over. They're in the open sea, they're lost in a featureless sea, and they have no idea where they even are. They can't get their bearings by the sun or the stars because of the overcast skies. They're at the mercy of nature out there. And then in verse 17, I was curious about this Syrtis. I don't know if you caught that as Tim was reading before. The Syrtis that they were so fearful of running aground on. Well, here's what I found out. The Syrtis was a notorious gulf there off the coast of Africa, full of shallows and sandbars and quicksands and hazards of all kinds. It had caused many a ruin and wreck, and it had passed into sailing notoriety. It was an obsessional fear of sailors, the Syrtis, and so they were terrified of ending up there. And it's been calculated that that Euro Aquila, when it picks up, the Northeaster, it could have blown a ship like this down onto that Syrtis in exactly that direction in just a couple of days. So they're fearful of that. And if you keep reading, they take all kinds of measures to try to avoid that. They don't want to end up on that course. Although all the while, of course, they don't have the luxury of knowing where they even are. It's a desperate situation. But amid 14 days of this hopelessness, they receive encouragement from God by courtesy of Paul. He says, I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. That's good news indeed in such circumstances. That's good news indeed for anyone on that ship who can hear that. That's great news. But we might notice, as we keep reading, that the storm doesn't suddenly stop. Plain sailing doesn't return. Eventually, on the 14th night of this, and verse 27, the sailors got a sense that they were nearing land. A sailor's intuition in the middle of the night. They confirmed that intuition with some depth soundings, 20 fathoms and then 15 fathoms. And a fathom, by the way, in case you're wondering, is the measure of a grown man's outstretched arms. It's 6 feet, so 120 feet, 90 feet. They're definitely approaching land, but they're in the dark, in the middle of the night, not even the starlight to guide them. They don't know what kind of land they're approaching. And they're worried, of course, that they're going to come unstuck on the rocks. So they let out all the anchors and try to slow this down until daylight comes. While others were letting down anchors, some of them started letting down the lifeboat in order to escape. Everyone else is letting down anchors and praying for daylight. A few sailors start letting down the lifeboat, trying to escape. But Paul lets the centurion know and tells them, look, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. It sounds a bit like Noah's sea journey at this point, where unless you stay under the promise that God has given, then you cannot be saved. Anyway, at last in verse 33, the light of day starts to break. And with further encouragement from Paul, and finally the peace of mind to even be able to just stomach some food, these men are no doubt feeling better as they, in the light of day, spy a nice beach to try and land this ship on, and they throw everything overboard. Everything goes over so that they can lighten the ship and try and get it in there on that beach as close as possible. And yet still, we might note, this adversity is not over. The ship hits a sandbar and starts getting broken up by the power of the waves. And so the men, well, they're either going to have to try to swim to shore Or they're going to have to grab on, use some of the flotsam and jetsam from the ship and try to drift their way into that beach. And all 276 men make it, just as God promised. But what an ordeal they've been through. As I mentioned earlier, as we zoom back out now, this passage raises a question we've already had to think about a little bit in Acts, in that Jesus commissioned Paul to carry his name to the world, specifically back in chapter 23, and again here in verse 24 of our passage today. Paul was sent by Jesus to Caesar in Rome. So why does Jesus seem to be hindering that? How many failed attempts have they had? 5.5 chapters before this, mind you, of Paul suffering at the hands of human opposition, now his mission seems to have been compromised by the wind and the waves. But this Jesus who sent Paul on this mission, isn't he the same one who commands the winds and the waves? That's what we read in Matthew's Gospel, for example, in chapter 8. We read about the time when Jesus got into the boat and his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea so that the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Are you of little faith?" Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. And the men marveled, saying, "What sort of man is this, that even winds and sea obey him?" So the question in front of us is a serious one. If Jesus controls the seas and the weather, then why is his apostle shipwrecked? The answer must once again be the same as last time we thought about this, that God's ways are just higher than our ways. But we want to dig in a bit more. The stormy weather here and the shipwreck here challenge the way we often think about adversity. They stretch the way we think about adversity. And I want to flag a couple of things in particular that this passage does to stretch out the way that we typically understand adversity. First of all, it's simply impossible to reconcile this passage with the idea that becoming a Christian leads to smooth sailing in life. Paul is undoubtedly a Christian, I'm sure we would all agree. But look at the example of his life. Not just this in Acts 27, but we read a snapshot before from his letter to the Corinthian church, the second letter to the Corinthians, just a quick smash and grab that he put together for them are the kind of things that he's suffered in his life. And that list in 2 Corinthians, by the way, it contained 3 shipwrecks. And that letter, by the way, 2 Corinthians, he's already written that. He wrote that from Macedonia before he went back to Jerusalem where all of this kicked off. So this is at least Paul's 4th shipwreck that we know of. I don't know about anyone else, but I'd be going nowhere near the water after maybe 1 shipwreck. But this is at least Paul's 4th time through this particular kind of adversity, not to mention all that other stuff that he's been through as a Christian. So it's simply not possible to harmonize this chapter of Acts here, nor the rest of the New Testament generally, if you want to check it out, with the popular idea out there that Christianity is somehow equals plain sailing. The other end of the spectrum, this passage also challenges an idea out there that we can always just read our given circumstances as if they were signs from God about what we should do. We always ask ourselves, should we do this or should we not do this? Sometimes we don't have much to go on. How readily do we sort of track along with the idea when things don't line up or when we feel like adversity is closing in, we suddenly think, this must be a sign telling me to go another way. Now, I'm not saying that can't happen or doesn't happen. In fact, it does happen. God used exactly that in Jonah's sea journey, if you remember the story of Jonah. But surely this chapter in Acts 27 teaches us that it can't always be that simple. It just can't always be that simple. Paul has clearly been told by Jesus that he must go to Rome. So all this adversity that he's up against here just cannot be interpreted in that particular way. It's just not all smooth sailing. And nor does rough seas and bad weather necessarily mean that we're on the wrong course. As much as we try to think in these ways, we like thinking of simple ways to process big things, but adversity is just more complex than that. It's more complex than that. As we dig in a bit deeper to passages like Acts 27, they help us get a better handle on adversity. They help us better understand adversity so that we can better respond to adversity. So I think that's what we should do with it this week. Let's think about some of the things that we know about adversity from the Bible, some of the things the Bible does assure us on to help us better understand and respond to it. First of all, we certainly know by this point that we may expect adversity. I mean, if we didn't know that from the Psalms already, if we didn't know that from the writings and the prophets in the Old Testament or the New Testament letters or Jesus' words in the Gospels themselves, certainly this book of Acts has taught us that we may expect adversity as Christians. Hardship is almost as if it's marked out for us, but we also know that God works all things for our good. Paul himself wrote that in the letter to the Romans. In chapter 8, verse 28, he said, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." That must include adversity. We also know that Jesus does have authority over everything. He has authority even over the winds and the waves, as I read earlier from Matthew 8. So if it needs to be calmed, he will calm it. But we also know that he doesn't always remove adversity from us, because here in Acts 27, Jesus doesn't calm this storm. Even though we might reasonably assume that Paul and Luke and Aristarchus and any other Christians on board, and probably half of the others as well, have probably been praying for that very thing, at least at some point in those 14 days lost at sea. If not, let's be realistic, constantly been praying for God to calm that storm. But Jesus doesn't calm this storm. So we know these things are all true, and we have to think about them all together. And what all these things must come together and tell us is that God has a higher view and a higher understanding and a higher way of working than you or I can even cope with. We can't always figure out what he's doing. But his ways are higher than our ways. The other side of that coin is that all of this adversity is not hindering Jesus' mission at all. It's not hindering Jesus' mission at all. Rather, Jesus is working his mission through this adversity. I think we can dig into a couple of things that we can understand about what Jesus is doing here, I think, if we probe it deeply enough. For one thing, I think he's shaping his believers. I think he shapes his believers through adversity. Look at the Apostle Paul here. Despite all the adversity coming against these men, Paul is remarkably calm and composed, it seems. Why? Well, I mean, for one thing, he got a visit from an angel with a message saying things are going to be all right in the end. Well, that would help. That would go a long way. You and I don't ordinarily get that kind of luxury, do we, about specific circumstances and specific situations. But there's more to Paul's confidence and optimism, I'm sure, than that message from an angel. Paul's composure here stems from what he has already learned through much and all kinds of adversity. Look more closely at his words there in verse 23. "For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong, the God whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I've been told.'" This stems to what Paul has already learned about God. Beyond the words from the angel there, Paul's confidence comes from who he knows, God. and from what he knows, that he belongs to God. He belongs to God, the God whose I am, the God who I worship. There's his confidence. This is the key to why Paul always seems to be the calmest person in the room, not just here in Acts 27, but all the time. I have faith in God, he says, verse 25. Whatever adversity is going on for Paul, he can say, I belong to God, I worship God, and I trust God. It's not actually about Paul. Paul would have the other Christians on board, I'm sure, say the same thing, even though they didn't get a message from an angel. Paul would have us say the same thing as well, I'm sure, because these things don't hinge on Paul or on us, but on God. It is the reliability and the goodness of our God that is in question here, not our personal measure of faith or anything like that. If we have faith as small as a mustard seed, we can say these things with Paul. Because it's not our mustard seed of faith that our hopes are pinned on. Our hopes are pinned on God. We belong to God. We worship God. We have faith in God. Most of us know God. Most of us here this morning know God. Praise the Lord. We might reflect more on the fact that we belong to God. What a beautiful thing that is. We belong to God. He bought us. We might commit ourselves more to worshipping God. And in these things, we must always be working more and more on our trust in God, as Jesus kept teaching those disciples. Our faith must be anchored ever more in who God is and what he has promised for us. So even in the most awful circumstances, even shipwrecks will still work for our ultimate good. Even if we don't get messages from angels about specific details and specific situations. I think the other reading this morning says the same thing in Matthew 14 that we read. Jesus called Peter out onto the water, into the storm and the wind and the waves, to come and walk to him. And Peter set out. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, are you a little faith? Why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? Faith and fear seem to be at opposite ends of the spectrum. Jesus is teaching Peter here to learn to think as Paul has learnt to think by Acts 27 here. I belong to God. I worship God. I have trust in God that it shall all be as he says. If Jesus called Peter out onto the water, then why did he doubt? And why did? Here's a question. Why did Jesus call Peter out onto the water, into the wind and the waves? Why did he do that? Why did he not calm this storm here for Paul? Well, again, we might try to reason through this and think maybe he was strengthening and refining their faith. Adversity is no hindrance to faith. Adversity is not the enemy of faith. Adversity is the refiner of faith, the strengthener of faith. So Paul gets a promise from God here in verse 20 and chapter 27 of Acts, a promise of deliverance. But nevertheless, God continues to work out that deliverance through ongoing adversity. So too, I can't help noticing it wasn't until Jesus and Peter got back into the boat that Jesus calmed that storm. Doesn't calm the storm here for Paul in Acts 27. He didn't calm the storm there for Peter either, till they were safely back in the boat. On the contrary, Jesus seems to use adversity to teach us, to strengthen our faith, to teach us to trust him all the more. Despite adversity, he grows us through adversity. But it's more than just our growth. It's more than just our growth that's going on here. These kinds of passages like this also teach us that Jesus uses us through adversity to grow others. That's what he's doing here again. As we learn to follow Jesus and we learn to trust in Jesus, we'd be more than just the calmest person in the room when the next crisis hits. We will testify to God's good name. We will testify to God's trustworthiness to others. In the middle of this storm, Paul's role here is to be a witness to 276 men, some of whom had ignored his advice at the start, some of whom were still fearing at the very end, trying to sneak away in the lifeboat. But look at the official decision that gets made by the Roman soldiers. Paul says, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. They cut loose the lifeboat and kissed it goodbye. Talk about faith in God's promise. They were told to stay together, and this is what they do. Their faith has been grown in this adversity through Paul's witness. God uses adversity and our faith in the middle of adversity to save others. Other people come to know God through our confident expression of faith. Other people are strengthened in their faith by our witness to it. So enough of Paul today. Because there are heroes of the faith sitting in this room. There are Christians in this room who've been through things I know nothing about. Christians in this room have been through things I can't even imagine. But here they sit. Because they belong to God. And they worship God, and they have faith in God that it will be just as he said to us in these scriptures. I want to leave you with two quotes, just a couple of quotes. I don't often do this, but I want to leave you with a couple of quotes to ponder through the week as you try to process this chapter. The first quote is from the late J.C. Ryle. He wrote this about 160 years ago, but... It's a good one because I reckon he sums up as best as I think we can this deeper, stranger dimension to adversity than we often think at. This is what he said. Let us mark well this lesson. If we are true Christians, we must not expect everything smooth in our journey to heaven. We must count it no strange thing if we have to endure sicknesses and losses, bereavements, disappointments, just like other men. Free pardon and full forgiveness, grace by the way, and glory at the end. All this our Saviour has promised to give. But he has never promised that we shall have no afflictions. He loves us too well to promise that. By affliction, he teaches us many precious lessons, which without it we should never learn. By affliction, he shows us our emptiness and weakness, draws us to the throne of grace, purifies our affections, weans us from the world, makes us long for heaven. In the resurrection morning, we shall all say, "It is good for me. It is good for me that I was afflicted." We shall thank God for every storm. Somehow or other, I think Paul would agree. Second quote's easier. It's from Jesus calling out to his disciples on that little boat as the wind and the waves pressed against them and they were so terrified. Jesus said, "Take heart. It is I. Do not be afraid." That's the bottom line from Jesus. And we belong to him. We worship him. And we must trust him. And thereby, as we do that, the world will learn that he is sovereign, that he is worthy of our praise, and that he is faithful to what he has promised us in his word. Can we now sing to him, our great Lord and Master? Please join me in singing.